From 89.7 WUWM, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, mathematician Eugenia Chang helps us grasp the concept of forever and a day.
Later, writer Kwame Alexander says literature can be a great tool for fostering empathy in young readers.
They see themselves, they see their friends. I think it's only when we begin to introduce, well, I think this book will be for my black kids. And this book should probably be for my white kids. And this book should be for my Latino kids. And so the adults begin to segregate the literature.
And photographer Margaret Musa talks about the medium in which she works, a process called tintype.
It had a lifespan from like the 1860s to the 1870s. And it is the wet plate process that came before film was even invented.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Okay, quick show of hands. How many of you feel math passed you by once you got beyond arithmetic? Well, Dr. Eugenia Chang says there are way too many of us who feel that way, and the reason is we were never taught math as a creative and passionate pursuit.
When she is not cooking or playing music, Dr. Chang teaches math to students at the Art Institute of Chicago and writes books to help the rest of us understand the beauty and wonder of math.
Her most recent is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics, and she joined me on the line from Chicago last spring. Dr. Chang, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Beyond Infinity, I have to say, I enjoyed this book very much, but my brain is still swimming a little bit.
Well, you know what? That means you're getting cleverer. Isn't that nice?
That is nice. Well, I hope that's what it is, as opposed to getting stupider, because there were times when I had to go back and reread something, you know, three or four times and think, I'm still not sure I quite get that. And that, of course, is part of the book, this idea that infinity is somehow very easy, say, for children to grasp, but very difficult for the rest of us.
That's right. And one of the reasons I was so excited to write about it is exactly that, that children love thinking about it, but it's really hard to pin it down. And that's okay. I think often with math, we get the idea that we're supposed to get the right answers and be able to answer the questions. And actually, that's one of the things that can be off-putting about it, because you might feel that if you can't understand it completely, then you're no good at it and it's time to do something else. But actually, we never understand it completely. And that's what drives us to discover more things, just like the fact that we can never eat in every restaurant in the city, for example. And that doesn't mean we give up trying. It just means, hooray, there's always more restaurants that we can discover.
I love that idea of mathematics as a series of restaurants, because I think if I had had that idea in my head when I was younger, I wouldn't have been so scared off and put off by mathematics.
I think that a lot of people are scared and put off math at a very early age by the way it's taught at school, which is very unfortunate. And I understand that, because some of my math classes at school weren't that interesting. And when it's all about following a formula or memorizing something and getting the right answer, it's not that interesting. It doesn't seem like it's something you can have fun with. Whereas at a higher level, we have a lot of fun with math and we kind of just make things up to see what will happen rather than trying to get the right answer. And one thing that I talk about in the book about infinity is that there are a lot of ways to think about infinity. There's not just one answer. What is infinity? We construct different amazing mathematical worlds in which infinity can mean slightly different things according to what we're trying to do. So there are lots of options, actually, and we don't usually present math as something with options and choices.
No, I tend to think of it, as you said, as this sort of this rigid formula thing that you must follow to get whatever the answer is, you know, solving for X.
People often think of math as being something that has rules that you have to follow. And if you don't feel like following them, then you feel like you just get kicked out of that world. Whereas in research math, if there's a rule you don't feel like following in math, then you invent a new mathematical world. And that's how research happens. And I often think it's because we don't like following those rules necessarily. It's just like the fact that maybe someone says to you at some point, oh, you're not allowed to take the square root of a negative number. And that's kind of annoying. And you might say, I want to take the square root of a negative number. And in math, you can just sort of make it up. And a lot of math comes from mathematicians sort of dreaming and using their imagination. And if we could capture that for children, then I think that we would not put children off, because children love dreaming, making things up, using their imagination, inventing games, making up their own rules, creating worlds. That's what math is about, really.
One of the things you said in the book that really struck me, and so much that I wrote it down, is that you gave an example of birds, and that we use science to study birds, but that we use mathematics to study itself.
That's right. I love that example, because when you're studying birds, you have to make up all sorts of things to study. You make up language. If you find a new bird, you give it a name. You invent, you create ways of categorizing birds and ways of describing their behavior. And with math, you invent ways to describe math. You might invent ways to describe numbers and then discover that you can also describe shapes and surfaces. But all the things that you invent to describe the math is itself a form of math. And so every time you answer a mathematical question, you've created more math that you can then discover. Whereas when you answer a question about birds, you haven't created a new bird. You've created a new theory about birds. Whereas when you make a new theory about math, it's math too, and so it keeps on growing, it keeps on reproducing, and there's always more of it that we can explore.
It's infinite in its own way.
Yes, it's not only infinite, but always growing. And I think that we will never be able to understand all of it, simply because every single thing that we understand creates a new thing that we haven't yet understood. And when we understand it, we will always create a new thing. It's just like the fact that there can't be a biggest number, because we could always add one and make a bigger one.
And some of the other fun things, these sort of mind-teasing, mind-expanding things examples that you give in the book, one of them was, why does infinity not fit into the world, but yet it fits into our brain?
I love that about our brains. Aren't our brains amazing? Let's just take a moment to think about how great our brains are, that we can encompass all of these ideas even though they don't really fit into the world. Some people like to study the real physical world, and that's great, and that's what scientists do. And that's really the difference between science and math. Science studies what the actual world around us is doing, and math studies anything that is logically possible. And one of the things I love about it is that that is so liberating, that I don't have to be constrained by physical reality. You know how often in normal life I feel frustrated by physical reality, like the fact that I can't actually eat any more of this ice cream because I'm full, or I haven't got enough time, or I wish there were more days in the week, or I wish I could go and see my friends on the other side of the world in an instant. And those physical constraints aren't there in the world of math. So I actually feel very, very liberated in it.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between math and science, because scientists, particularly I'm thinking physicists and astrophysicists, cosmologists, use the world of mathematics to help them with their work. And so how do those things interact?
I like to think of math as being there to help everybody, which is a whole different viewpoint, because so many people unfortunately think of math as something that's there to torture you when you're in school. Whereas really, we're just trying to help everyone understand things. So just in the same way that science is there to help us understand the world, math is there to help us understand, well, science a lot of the time, because what we're saying is that if we ignore some of the details about a situation, that's what abstraction is. We, instead of thinking about a real world situation, we ignore some of the details to turn it into an idea or an idealized idea of the world. And then lots of different situations become the same as each other, so that we can study them all at once and save effort. It's all about being lazy, really, that you don't want to do the same thing over and over again. So you find the part that everything has in common, and you study that by itself, and that's math. And then when you're actually studying the real situation, like an actual planet or a spaceship or a train or a bridge, then you put the details back in, but the theory part, the math part, will make a lot of it work for you without you having to do it all over again.
It's like it gives the structure on which you can look at all of the other things that aren't the same.
Exactly. It's like the structural walls inside a building. And then, of course, you put the rest of the building up so that all the buildings end up being different. But if you start with a basic structure, that's a much more efficient way of, say, building a lot of houses. And this is how a lot of houses are often built, with the same underlying structure and then just some differences on the outside so that everyone can feel like they've got their own home.
One of the things that you do in addition to thinking about and doing mathematics is you are also a baker. You are a chef, and you have written books about that. And of course, measurements, we can think about measurements as a part of mathematics. But I want to take it out a little bit more. How does thinking about theoretical math affect how you approach food?
It's really a lot more than just measurements and scaling up recipes, although that does come into it. It's about thinking about how things work and not necessarily just wanting to follow other people's instructions. And I think that following recipes in a recipe book is a lot like doing the formulae and the equations at school that you're told to do over and over again. And that's fine as a starting point, but isn't it more fun when you make up your own recipes and then decide whether you like the result or not? And in order to do that well, it's really better if you understand the principle behind how the recipe works so that you understand what each ingredient is actually doing in there. And it's the same with math, that math is there to say, let's understand what the principles are behind all these situations. First of all, because it's just interesting, I think. And secondly, because if you understand it well, then you can invent new ones. You can change the situation a bit to suit your needs. You can fix it when it's broken. And you can experiment and you can make something that's really your own, not just something that someone else told you to do. And I think that this is key, one of the keys anyway, to showing that math is interesting and for everybody, because children love creating their own things. And if you don't have a chance to create your own thing and make it yours, then it becomes a bit boring. And so children who like creating their own things, at that point, they'll turn away from math and prefer things like writing stories or drawing pictures, because they think that's where they get to be an individual. Whereas actually in math, you can create your own things as well, or you can at least feel like you're creating your own things, and then you can care about it more, just like when you've invented your own recipe.
You're talking about math as a creative pursuit.
Yes, and this is how I teach art students at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, because of course they're all art students, so they're all creative, they're all quite visual, hands-on learners, and most of them were put off math in school because of all those things we've been talking about, because they didn't like things where they could be wrong, that they didn't like memorizing things, it didn't seem relevant to them. Whereas when I tell them that math is about looking at the world and interpreting it in a certain way, then they're really interested, because that's all they do as artists, look at the world and interpret it through a particular lens or with a particular viewpoint. And so I say, well, we're going to interpret the world through the point of view of logic. And in order to do that, we're going to perform abstractions so that we move into the world of ideas. And then it becomes a bit like conceptual art, where you're playing around with ideas to see what will happen and see what you can express and see what aspects of a situation you can illuminate. And when we're doing math, we choose which parts of a situation we're going to focus on. And it's not completely obvious always. There are lots of different ways you can focus on a situation. If you just take shapes, for example, you can focus on how pointy they are, in which case a triangle is really different from a circle. Or you could focus on just how many holes they have, in which case a triangle is really kind of the same as a circle. It's just an outside with a hole in the middle.
What a wonderful way to think about it. Just that little comparison makes my brain go, ooh.
Oh, well, that's good. You see, you got cleverer again.
Yes, it's that whole getting cleverer. So getting back to infinity, which is what you're coming up here to talk about, this book, Beyond Infinity. What do you think is beyond infinity?
Well, there's a whole lot more infinities out there. And that's one of the mind-boggling things that I love explaining, that infinity isn't just one thing, but there's even bigger infinities. And no matter what infinity you think of, there's an actual bigger one. And you might go, what on earth can that possibly mean? Well, math has a way of making sense of that in a way that's really quite precise. And one of the things it tells us is that our gut instincts about things like infinity tell us one thing, but then if we try and actually scrutinize it with logic and think really clearly about it, then weird things happen that kind of contradict our gut instincts, like the fact that infinity can't be the biggest thing because you could construct a bigger infinity from any infinity that you think of.
You just and add one.
Well, you can. It depends on what kind of infinity you're thinking of. So some types of infinity, you add one and it just gets absorbed into the infinity and it's still infinity. But other types, you add one and it doesn't get absorbed. It's a really new thing. And one of the things I say in my book is I think it's like when Shakespeare said forever and a day. And I think he knew that forever and a day is longer than forever, because you have to wait for the whole of forever and then another day. And he knew it was longer than forever. Otherwise, he'd have just said forever. That's what I think anyway.
Do you have any last thoughts for us on infinity and why it's important that we should even be thinking about it?
Well, math is important because it's useful, but that's not only why it's important. It's also important because of how it shows us how to think. And thinking about infinity, it's not that you really need to think about infinity in your daily life, but it's a great kind of practice for how to think clearly about things and how to clear up the difference between your gut instinct and things that hold up according to logic. And I think that the feeling that you keep referring to of your brain kind of swimming and not understanding something, I think that that's good and it's something to embrace. And that, like, when you're on a boat at sea and it's rocking up and down, and if you try and resist it, then you'll get seasick. But if you can kind of go with it, then you can start to enjoy the rocking motion, and then you can see all the wonderful creatures that are out there and admire the landscape. And for me, math is often about admiring the landscape, the amazing ideas that are out there, and appreciating how powerful human minds actually are.
Dr. Eugenia Cheng is a mathematician, chef, and musician. She is a scientist in residence at the Art Institute of Chicago and an honorary fellow at the University of Sheffield in the UK.
Cheng is the author of How to Bake Pie and her newest book, Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. We first spoke with her in April.
Writer Kwame Alexander says he hopes his novels for middle grade students help kids see the humanity in everyone. We'll talk with him and musician Randy Preston after a break. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer Kwame Alexander's books for middle grade readers are one way that young people are coming together instead of moving apart. Alexander has penned more than a dozen books for young readers before writing The Crossover, a novel in verse about two basketball-playing twin brothers.
It won the Newbery Medal in 2015 and was followed by another novel in verse, Booked, with a soccer theme. The books have drawn in boys and girls regardless of ethnic background and have been hailed for making poetry cool.
Another of Alexander's recent books returns to basketball as a metaphor, but it's not a novel. It's a collection of poems and essays called The Playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game Called Life. He and musician Randy Preston spoke at a couple of Milwaukee area schools last spring.
They stopped by the Lake Effect studio as well and offered up a few songs from the mixtape they also recorded based on Alexander's books, including this tune.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting The Playbook by Kwame Alexander and Randy Preston.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Are you recording?
Day and night.
Day and night.
Let it shine.
Let it shine.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Fourth grade. Fifth
Day
grade.
And night.
Sixth grade.
Let it shine.
It doesn't matter. You gotta believe in yourself, even when it seems that no one else does. Never let anyone lower your goals. Always shoot for the sun and you will shine. You've got to know the greatness that comes before you. You've got to know the greatness that comes with you.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Join in, Mitch.
Day and night.
Day and night.
Let it shine.
Let it shine.
Be a star in your mind.
That's Randy Preston.
Day and night. Let it shine.
We are sharing some axioms and proverbs from The Playbook. 52 rules to aim, shoot,
and score in the game of life. It's all about being a star, which is why we're glad to be here today in the studio of the biggest star here in Milwaukee. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr.
Mitch Tyke.
Mr. Mitch Tyke.
Yes, Mitch, yes, Mitch, 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 Mitch.
And the crowd goes wild.
Well, Kwame Alexander and Randy Preston, welcome to Lake Effect. It's, I mean, really a thrill to have you here.
It's great to be back, Mitch. Well, it's great to be in the studio with you.
Pleasure.
All right, so let me ask you, how do you see Playbook connecting to its spiritual cousins, the Booked and before that, the crossover?
Spiritual cousins sounds so so divine.
Mm. But it's good, though. I like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the crossover featured these two boys, Josh and JB, who were stars on and off the court, who had a really cool, funny, you know, dad who shared these basketball rules for life with them. And the rules really resonated with young people as I traveled around the country, and I thought, well, I should really write more rules, you know? Mm-hmm. And so decided to write, you know, 42 more rules and ended up creating 52 rules to help you aim, shoot, and score in the game of life. And sort of the where it came from was, as a child, I remember hearing sort of sayings and weird, I guess, proverbs from my grandparents and my father. My grandmother used to say things like, dishwater gives back no images.
What in the world?
Exactly. I would be like, what are you talking about? Yeah. My father would say, you can't know what you don't know.
And that's really true, I think.
It is, but as an eight-year-old, you're like, what in the world
what
are you talking about?
What does it mean?
And so I wanted to write a book about some of that stuff that I still remember, but do it in a way that would be cool for, like, kids. Like your daughter, Mitch.
Well, I think my daughter already thinks you're cool. But, you know, I was reading this book and thinking about how she might take to the advice in it. And, you know, I was wondering, do you think not just her, but, you know, many of your young readers will get that, you know, even though the inside papers of this book are textured like a basketball, that a lot of these lessons are about more than just fast breaks, that this is about life?
Nah, who cares?
Right, right.
I mean, we don't concern ourselves with that. Here's why. And I'm being flippant when I say who cares.
Right.
I shouldn't be. Because I do care. That's why I'm here.
Exactly.
But here's what I mean.
And God bless you for it.
Basketball is the hook. Mm-hmm. Sports is the metaphor. When they read the crossover, yeah, we want them to quick shoulder shake, a slick eye fake. Number 28 is way past late. He's reading me like a book, but I turn the page and watch him look. We want them to get all that. But we also want them to get the message about how family is so important. About friendship. And I think they're going to get that. You know, I'm not the didactic writer. I'm the clever, you know, under the cover. Call me the undercover brother. I'm delivering a message because I do write with an intentional message. And the goal is for you to get that, but for not for me to beat you over the head with it. So I'm all about using sports as a metaphor. And with the hopes, if I'm doing my job well enough, that the kids are going to take away some messages that are more about life off the court.
Do you think they'll listen to you and read you, Kwame Alexander, or listen to you, Randy Preston, in a way that they might not listen to their parents if they were saying the same thing?
I absolutely think that. I think that...
That's Randy talking, y'all.
Yeah, I think that when...
Randy, when you talk, you should probably like play the guitar before you start.
Oh, just as a little key?
Yeah,
as
yeah
a
just
little,
so they know. Randy's about to talk.
As I was saying, I honestly think that when kids are presented with an experience, I think what happens when we show up, it's author visit. Yeah, they've heard an author before, but now we have an experience that we're offering. So there's more than simply, my name is blah, 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 blah. And I think that it opens them up to more information that we're giving, more messages, more thematic stuff that we're talking about, and they're more aware of it. And then we're open to it. And so I think that, you know, one of the cool things about this tour specifically is that we're really pushing a message to the kids of being okay with who you are. You know, you're a nice guy. You're an okay person. You can be whatever you want to be. And when kids are exposed to that and they see it as a reality and they see us being fun with it and having, you know, we're jumping around the stage, they're coming up, they're trying out new things, they're doing things they've never done. We have kids getting up and reading and rapping in front of whole crowds of their peers and they do it well. So I think that is something that gives them a little confidence, and I really like the approach that we're taking with it.
And then the other piece of it is, Mitch, is that a kid will respond a little bit more favorably to you know, authors who are coming to their school than their parents.
Right.
And so maybe we can reach them in some ways that the parents can't.
Right.
Well, and maybe the light goes off and they realize that their parents aren't entirely full of it.
Exactly.
Right. Right. That's the hope.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, and not to attach too much significance to the middle grade age, but maybe to attach some significance to it. Do you feel like, is that an age where you really, I don't want to say it's the last great opportunity to do that, but it's a pretty pivotal time. By the time they're in high school, there's a lot of stuff that's starting to, if it's, you know, concrete, it's starting to set.
I think there's still room in high school, but I think, to your point, yes, middle school is sort of like the last chance to mold and shape in a really profound way that's significantly easier than when you get to 10th and 11th grade.
Yeah.
The middle school kids are about to cross over, you know, into, see what I did there?
I saw what you did there.
Yeah. It's a product placement there,
exactly.
I think.
Very nice.
They're about to cross over and hopefully get booked. No, no. No, they're about to cross over into young adulthood, right. You know.
The surf's up, if you will.
Yes,
and that's why we have to offer them some rules for life, you know, the playbook.
Hey, work it out. Work it out. I think that at the middle school age, especially, I got to do the intro. The middle school kids. No, at that age, they're suggestible. They're still trusting of adults, even people who are strangers to a degree. They trust them. So there's an opportunity there to talk to a kid about something that may be meaningful to them that they've never thought about. But because you're an adult and you have that, you know, you're taller and bigger and low voice as a man, you know, they're going to listen in a way that they may not listen to someone who's saying the same thing every day to them.
Right.
You know, I think about, you know, I've seen videos of kids interacting with you guys at schools, and I was there at Boswell the last time you were in town, and I mean, there's a certain excitement that they get from being in your presence, if you will. I was wondering, what is it like on the other side? I mean, is there a rush in some ways connecting with kids, and you see those moments happen? You know, not that this is a selfish exercise for you, but it's got to be an amazing feeling.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we feed off of that energy.
Yeah.
We just, you know, while in Milwaukee, we had two presentations, one for about 800 kids and one for about 700 kids in really large theaters. And the energy was just bananas.
It was amazing.
And when we see a group of students respond to poetry, respond to literature, respond to the books in that way where they're clapping and chanting and the call and response is through the roof, it feeds us because ultimately we're really trying to, and it may seem a bit, you know, lofty, but our goal is to change lives.
Absolutely.
We're trying to allow children to have the space to become better human beings. You know, because the thing is, when adults do things that have a negative impact on our world, you know, for example, when we look at some of the shootings of young black men that have taken place in our country, and we wonder about what transpired, what was going through that officer's mind in that moment. You know, I posit that adults, the mind of an adult begins in the imagination of a child. Mm. And so to the degree that we can create these well-rounded, connected, empathetic human beings as children, when they get older, we won't have to wonder what's in their mind because we will have helped create a mind that is all about making the world a better place. By any means necessary. And so when I see children responding to what to the messages, you know, to the ideas and the ideals, that's it. That's why we do this. And so you got something like that, and then you have something like we are introducing books, training teachers, building a library in a village in Ghana.
I was going to ask about that. So you have this Leap for Ghana program impacting lives on a whole different scale.
On a whole different scale. I mean, you're talking about changing the outlook, the makeup, the opportunities, the resources for our entire village of 200 children and their families.
Right.
And there was one book in their classroom. It was 11 classrooms, one book. What we're talking about is that books allow you to open up a world of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
They allow you to see outside of your own condition and begin to see things that are possible. And so whether it's a boy in Milwaukee who's going to now read a book, or whether it's an entire village who has access to books that they see themselves in and see what's possible, we're all about creating language and literature and opportunities for young people to be changed.
And at the same time, I mean, I think it's interesting because I think it was in your Newbery acceptance speech where you made reference to the fact that adults are really hung up on what ethnicity the kids in your books are, and the kids that read them, they aren't. And it feels like there's empathy is linked to kids' ability to see themselves in these characters regardless of what their physical description is.
I think you hit the nail on the head. That's another thing my grandmother used to say. It's tough for adults to sort of, to see past that. Like, the kids get it. Like, yeah. The kids, they see themselves, they see their friends, and I think it's only when we begin to introduce, I think this book will be for my black kids.
Right.
And this
right.
book should probably be for my white kids, and this book should be for my, Latino kids,
or this is for girls,
or this is for boys. And so the adults begin to segregate the literature. And then we wonder why kids grow into adults who aren't empathetic, who aren't connected outside of their own house, neighborhood, community.
If you can't see the humanity in another person, then you have no reason to. You have there's nothing that's going to prompt you as an adult
right.
to seek that out.
Right.
And so if you've never learned that or you've never experienced that in your childhood, there's very, very few opportunities for that to happen as an adult.
Talk about how the mixtape came about.
That's a great question,
especially
since it started here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, in the top of
last year in April, we were on tour for the novel Booked, and we were in the Hotel Pfister last year. We were in the lounge on the 23rd floor, eating dinner, hanging out, and we began to talk about some of the components of our presentations, and we thought maybe we should do a song about one of the books that I had written called Acoustic Rooster. And his barnyard band, mm-hmm. about a rooster that started a jazz band with Duck Ellington and Miles Davis. And so...
It's a shame Elephants Gerald couldn't be there.
Exactly. There you go. And so we sat there and we wrote this song.
Acoustic roosters, barnyard band, up next in Farmer's Talent Show. Bee started humming, duck dove right in, rooster and pork chop set the flow, and the band they played,
and the band they played,
and the barnyard dance,
join in,
and the barnyard dance, and the singer sang, and the singer sang, everybody jam,
everybody jam. And so we just sat there and we wrote this song, and then we said, well, let's do a song for Surf's Up, and then let's do a song for Booked. And then, of course, with the playbook, we thought, well, that's, a perfect opportunity for us to share this passionate, sort of call and response piece that deals with the power of saying yes to life and understanding your own confidence. And there was a kid in Singapore, and I had him write a rule, and he wrote this rule that has become the one that we do in schools. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, swish. And so, we figured let's give it some rhythm and rhyme. So the mixtape came out of that, and we ended up doing a CD for little kids, featuring songs based on my picture books, and then one for the bigger kids featuring my novels and the playbook.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like, would you leave us with one more song from the mixtape?
Sure. What do you want to do?
What are we going to do? I guess we'll do the Mac.
Okay. I like that one. You going to set that up?
Yeah. So we want to thank Mitch for having us today. We want to thank everybody for listening to this amazing show. Lake Effect is in the house.
Lake Effect, baby.
Randy Preston is on the guitar. You can Kwame me on my cell phone. Here we go. This is a poem from Booked, B-O-O-K-E-D. It's about a 12-year-old boy who hates reading and he loves soccer. And he hates reading until he meets a really cool librarian who gives him a playbook for life. The Mac drinks tea in a dragonfly mug. On the library floor is a dragonfly rug. The door is covered in dragonfly pics, cause Skip to the Mac is dragonfly sick. Sometimes I wear a dragonfly hat. Got dragonfly this and dragonfly
that.
Dragonfly this and dragonfly
that.
Dragonfly this and dragonfly that around my room. Our dragonfly clocks, but please don't touch my dragonfly box, cause if you do, I might get cross. Respect Mitch, y'all, the dragonfly boss. That's right.
That's right.
That was totally, that was like 50 degrees of awesome. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Mitch,
pleasure,
for having
man.
Us.
Absolutely.
Lake Effect.
Writer Kwame Alexander and musician Randy Preston. Alexander is the author of a book for middle grade readers called The Playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game Called Life. He's also the author of Booked and the Newbery Medal winning The Crossover.
We will take one last break and then meet the current artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel, photographer Margaret Musa. We'll learn about the 150-year-old technique she uses when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Since 2009, Milwaukee's Pfister Hotel has been sponsoring a unique artist's residency program. For 12 months, the artist selected sets up shop in a space off the lobby by the elevators on the first floor and practices their art in full view of the public. The artists have been painters, sculptors, fabric artists, and this year, a photographer.
But don't look for a DSLR or even a Polaroid point and shoot. Margaret Musa works with glass plates and an early photographic technique that predates film called tintype. I visited her Pfister studio back in May, and she began by describing how she set up the studio space.
It is a dark green walled room that almost looks like a living room and less like an art gallery or an art studio. I think I did that because I kind of have a problem with white walls. And I don't really know why that's a thing for art galleries and art spaces. Especially for me, if this is going to be a place that I create, I want to be comfortable here.
So the Pfister allows you to change the wall colors and kind of make, you can't make, you know, physical changes like taking out walls, but you can change your colors.
That's correct. And I also, I have a dark room here too that was easy to make with the closet that was already in here. I just switched the light bulbs and put red ones in.
So tell me what it is you do. I know tintypes are involved. And so maybe for those of us who don't exactly know what that is, we might have heard the word, but we don't know what it means. Explain that, if you would.
Sure. Tintype was a method that was very common in the 1800s. It documented all of the Civil War and part of the Wild West. It had a lifespan from like the 1860s to the 1870s. And it is the wet plate process that came before film was even invented. So it starts with a liquid emulsion that I pour directly onto a piece of tin or a piece of glass. And through a series of chemical steps, it becomes light sensitive. And I load it into the back of a large format view camera where I expose it from anywhere between 1 second if I have all my lights, or if we're outside, maybe 6 or 10 seconds, and I develop it right away. So it's a little different than film too, because it's not as though I could take the tintype and develop it the next day or a week later. I have actually about 10 minutes when I have to develop it. It's called the wet plate process because the whole thing, development and all, has to happen while the first element of chemistry is wet. So anywhere I go with my camera, anywhere I want to take a photo, I have to be within walking distance of a dark room of sorts and all of my chemistry.
So that means if you're outside doing this, you have to really bring an entire kit with you. You have to bring an entire dark room and all of the materials with you.
That's right. I have that in my trunk. I kind of turn my trunk into a dark room for times like that.
Do you crawl in and actually develop in there?
I just stand against the trunk and have curtains that wrap behind me, blackout cloth that wraps up behind me.
So how did you get involved and interested in this particular thing? Like you said, it only had about a 10-year span before like glass plates and other things were invented that kind of took the photographic process forward. So why are you interested in this older process?
That's a good question. It did have a very short life because it is a very fussy chemical process, and it is not easy. But, you know, when I started this, I was ready for a challenge in my life, I think, and so it sounded really hard, but also it sounded like the results were really worth it. And I was always interested in history and old things, and that meant old photographs, and so I was always curious about why an old photograph looked so different to me and why I liked it so much.
So what does doing this process, this difficult, finicky process, do for you artistically that film, say, wouldn't do for you?
I have my hands in every step of making a photograph, from mixing the chemistry in the beginning to, you know, exposing and developing. And that's not something that I could say, I think, in regards to film. So it's great because I have control over every little thing, but then oftentimes with this process, things go wrong and nothing shows up, or there's a bunch of fog and chemical, you know, artifacts all over the plate. And so it can be really challenging and really frustrating. But I'm learning all the time and I enjoy learning. So it's fun for me to make progress and to keep chipping away at this process.
Did you go to someone to train initially, or did you figure all of this out using YouTube?
YouTube has helped me since, but I took a 2-day workshop in New York a few years ago and just kind of got the basics on how to take a tintype, but that did not include how to mix all the chemistry and how to troubleshoot when something went wrong. So really after that, I was on my own.
And so evidently you're not the only person doing this process. So there are, truly are, I was kind of joking about YouTube, but evidently there really are YouTubes about how to do this, how to mix the chemicals and how to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's funny to think that because of the internet, it's made it so much easier to make a photograph from this old time. And, you know, even ordering all my chemistry is extremely simple. If it wasn't for the internet, I probably wouldn't be able to do this at all. I wouldn't have found it, and I wouldn't be able to find who supplies the chemicals. And so, yeah, I have some tintype acquaintances online that I communicate with, and there are some YouTube videos that can help a little bit, but mostly I find that all my problems that I encounter with this process, I really have to just put in the work myself and test different things to figure out what's happening.
What is the public's reaction to this? Are people excited to get their pictures taken using this technology?
Yeah, I find that people that aren't even comfortable usually getting their photo taken really enjoy seeing what this process does. My uncle, for example, on the wall behind you, there's not a lot of photos of him, but when I brought all my chemistry up north for a family vacation, I wanted to photograph my aunts and uncles and my siblings and stuff in that setting. And he saw what I was doing, and I asked him if I could take his tintype. And at first he said no, but then when he saw the tintype of another relative of mine, he thought it was really cool. And then he did let me, and actually his photo is one of my favorites I've ever taken.
And this is this fellow right here with the beard?
Yes, that's my Uncle Tom.
One of the things, just looking around your studio and looking at the photos that you have up here, is that there's sort of an intimacy to it. Like this photograph of your uncle, it's actually kind of soft around the edges.
Right. That's an effect of the camera. But also in regards to the intimacy of this process, I think that this is very different because it takes a while to make one photo. And usually it's just me and a subject, and we spend at least an hour to make one photo. And that is really special these days when we're all used to taking a million pictures on our cell phone and deleting all of them but the one that we like the best. You know, I'm really taking a lot of time to make sure that the one photo we take is the one that we like best. So there is intimacy in that.
It's almost like before you even start, you're deleting options before you actually take the photograph, because you want to end up with just the one. You can't take more unless you set all up again.
Right. That's probably why I'm very serious when I'm working on a photo. I think my mood really changes when I get down to the time to take one. People have told me that before too. Maybe it's not.
You get very focused.
I think, right, I get really focused because I probably am deleting all the things that I know aren't going to work and making sure that I'm putting in place all the right things that do.
When you work with a subject, how much do you try to get to know them ahead of time, or do you try to let that just evolve as you're getting the photography set up, everything set up? Are you trying to find out, or do you want them to reveal themselves to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. Usually I don't know much about people when they come to sit down, but we get to talk a little bit and I get to at least get a feel for their personality when they come in and I see their reaction to my space and the things I have on the wall. So I can usually tell right away what type of session it's going to be, but it's always really fun for me to get to that moment when we get to see the photo in the end. And usually after that is when everyone can take a deep breath, sigh of relief, and then we get to spend about 20 minutes together while the tintype washes and before I varnish it. It's nice to get to know people in that time.
You know, we're sitting in a hallway in the Pfister Hotel, and there are people, as we're doing this interview, looking in and wondering what's going on, not just with us, but, you know, with the entire thing. Do you overhear people wondering what's going on? And do you invite them in after?
Yes, I can hear everything that people say right outside of my door. Kind of is like a fish tank in here. There's big glass windows that look into the whole space. And usually people notice the big giant camera that I have resting on a table in the window. And I hear a lot of discussion about that and what that is. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize it's a camera until I pop my head out a lot and say to come on in. And I talk a lot about my process, spend a lot of time telling people what a tintype is and showing them my dark room and the images on the wall. It's really fun.
Let's walk over to that, because I didn't realize it was a camera
either.
So let's, if you can tell me how it works, that's really cool.
It works exactly the same as my small 4x5. It's just on a much larger scale. So the whole thing is on a giant wooden track with some brass fixtures and knobs that move the front and back of it forward. And there's a giant lens sticking out on the front here. It's an old Kodak lens. And I'm not sure if this one came on the camera originally or not, but it is the right lens to cover as large of a space as 2 feet by 2 feet, which is as big of a tintype I'll be able to make once I get it working, which I'm very close to doing.
So are you just having to fix it, or is it just getting it settled in its space?
It needs no fixing. This camera is in really good shape. I just need to build a few things and modify a few things to be able to take a tintype with it. I need the accessories to go with the camera, but this camera is ready to go. I found this on Craigslist and drove to Louisville, Kentucky for it.
I was going to ask you where you found it. Yeah. Was it working there? Did they have, or was it just sitting somewhere in somebody's barn?
It was sitting in someone's living room, and they had just had a baby, so I think they wanted this thing out of there because it takes up quite a lot of space.
It sure does. I mean, the whole thing is, it looks like it's about 4 feet long, the whole frame underneath, and right. then it stands about, what, 2 feet high, 3 feet
yeah.
high?
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's in really good shape. And then what we would see if we had turned this to some more light and a subject, we would see the image projected on the back, upside down and backwards is how it would appear on the ground glass there that I made. And so we would be able to focus the camera by moving this steering wheel of a knob, which is made out of brass, on the side there. And then once we got you in focus, you'd have to be pretty still while I prepare a huge tintype. This is all stuff that I'm thinking about. I haven't been able to do it yet, but I'm close. I'm really excited to see what type of photo I'll be able to take with a camera like this.
So what do you hope to get from this year's residency? Besides a place to work, which is a wonderful thing, and a public that goes by pretty regularly that you can say, come in and see what's going on, what is this going to do for your practice?
It's done a lot already. Just being here and meeting so many people and getting to talk about this process, it, I think, has really solidified for me the fact that this is what I'm going to be doing for a very long time. And I don't know if that's something I knew for sure before I came in here, but getting everyone's reactions and everyone's support especially has really made that very clear to me. And so I'm really excited to use every moment of this year to plug away at getting better at this process and making work that impresses me.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out, for showing me around here, and best of luck. Maybe in a couple of months we'll come back and see how this big boy is doing here.
Please do. Hold me to that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Tintype photographer Margaret Musa is the current artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel. She will be in residence there through the spring, and you can see some of her work and the studio space at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.